some very prominent customers. For example, he did quite a lot of work, I understand, at St. James's Palace. So the firm was in Victorian capitalist circles, quite highly regarded. But like all of us, he was trying to keep several balls in the air. But I think really from the romantic point of view, you can see most of his, well, a lot of his romanticism in the writings of there, the knights and
the
shining armour appear more or less.
The interesting thing to me, I mean, I find his writing not very easy to adjust to. What's fascinating me in the little bits I've read about the trial of Guinevere is that it is modern, it's not romantic. He is using that setting to examine some rather painful relationships and this is often done, of course, by writers who are out of their own time and place so that nobody can be accused of dealing with their own personal life. But that's what it obviously was in this particular case. So that's another reason for picking a society where people know what roughly what the parameters of that society were. These are the values of that society, this is the way they behave or supposed to behave and all the rest of it. And you can see it's like setting a science fiction conundrum. While some people in this room have heard me launch on about sex in this party quite a number of times, I've decided that perhaps I'd better give it the rest of a few years, you know. I think 6 minutes is obvious. what I have said, I can remember saying it at that day school we had at Students' Union in London. One of the things which I hate capitalism most for is the way in which it has crippled down emotional personalities. I'm very well aware of being crippled, and I can do nothing really about it. And I think it's pervades society. I'm not the only one, not by any means. And perhaps I'm not as badly off as some people. But I'm not as badly off as the blokes who presumably have abducted that little girl. I mean, this is terrifying stuff. And it's evidence of what precious society, what those pressures of society can do to produce horrors. I mean, there's no doubt about it that Belsen and Auschwitz had a heavy sexual activity. This is the crippled sexuality producing horrors like this. The sex drive is enormously powerful, and if something's done to keep the pressure in, then it's going to come out in all sorts of horrible ways. And I've forgotten what's the key part of your question. Did you ask me about capitalism, or did you ask me about socialism? Right. Yeah, there's an enormous number of questions here. I mean, one of the things which I'm forced to say, in spite of what I've just said, is that I think but it's capitalism which is made in socialists, and part of that is this deferred gratification thing. I think a lot of us are, to some extent, self-sacrificing for the cause of socialism. I think probably more normal human beings wouldn't bother, but then because they'd be normal, they wouldn't have the need to be. They would be living in a society with a good soul of peace. So capitalism produces really quite strong wages in some ways, you know, and, without that energy which is coming from somewhere. I mean, I'm a Freudian, if I'm anything, I think it is a source of energy, and it can be channeled, and it can be channeled into revolution in many cases. But in a socialist society, I'm fascinated by it. I've tried to deal with it. Of course, we don't know. We have never had experience of non-oppressive society. We have never had experience of what a few remaining primitives were found to have. And many of those that we found, we've only found them that late because they've been in the most inhospitable places in the world anyway, and therefore they've had a very peculiar existence. So I think probably the most normal have been the pygmies, who simply lived in jungle South Africa, South American Indians, so impenetrable a jungle that we couldn't get at until now. Well, it does. You see, it's fascinating that when, for example, Francis Huxley went and lived amongst a tribe of South American Indians, what he found extremely difficult was that they had no conception of privacy whatsoever. Whatever functions that you were performing, everybody was interested in. Now, for an average middle-class chap like Huxley, this was severely disturbing, you know. Can you find the seats? There's one in the front of you, once said. You see, I think this is a society which is obsessed by sex. I think it is a contradiction, I suppose, in a way, that because capitalism keeps the...
I'm not obsessed, I'm going.
Okay. Keeps the lid on, or the cork in the bottle all the time. It comes out, you know, it's useful for advertising, you can sell motor cars with it, you can sell newspapers, you can sell pornography with it, you can, and all the rest of it. And there is a vested interest in sexual repression, really. I think in a socialist society that sexual pressure will go down enormously. For a start off, women going through all the silicon implants and depilation and deodorants and all the stuff which is a part of the sort of marriage market business, you know. I wouldn't think so. I mean, they could please themselves what sort of lives they live, but if they choose to do it, I don't. And women are no more lame than men are, judging by historical examples and different societies, then it can be just as bad. So it's not that, it's all to do with the power positions in society. And if men were the subject sex, they would no doubt be trying to prettify themselves up to... Well, they do in some societies. I mean, slavery left a legacy of males flitting around on the outside of families. Didn't live in the West Indies. Female was the family head. And men who wanted to attract women either got to be exceptionally imaginative lovers, or they've got to be particularly handsome and good dancers and all the rest of it. In other words, they've got to be pretty. Now, I don't think in a socialist society any of that's not going to be that impression. And I think some people might find it a bit dull, you know. I mean, some people's days are brightened by page 3 of the Sun, I understand. It's about the only bit of joy they get in the day, which is often sad reflection on the nature of the society. But I don't know what sexual behaviour will be like, and I don't think anybody else does.
Danny Preston.
Yeah, I see sex as an appetite. We have an appetite for it. And my dad was telling me about when he was in the prison of Walker. I mean, I never got much to eat, and he told me that he never, ever, ever thought about food. He just thought about food. And it's like in our society today, I mean, we get sexuality in our tradition, our cultural ancestors. It's not enough, it's not fulfilling, it doesn't really satisfy our appetite. So that means it's unsatisfied and obsessed by sex, we think about it all the time. But you know, in the same society, the rational society, where we come to terms with our sexuality, we seek to and do understand it. And I think we'll get to, like, our appetite for food, our appetite for sex will be understood, and we'll self-regulate.
Yeah. What I was going to say is, I disagree with your whole approach to this, because you self-confess to be a Freudian. And I think Freud was bored. the whole language you were using, sexual energy being diverted, interpreting concentration camps as something sexual. There's no basis for that. Hold on a second. He was assuming it was, the other bloke, right, ended up mad, chanting with an orgone meter, trying to measure orgasms. Because he really believed that there was a physical form of energy which could be described as sexual energy. And the whole of the theory of sexual repression and so on is based on the existence of this energy, which hasn't been proved scientifically to exist at all. It's all speculation. And as was pointed out in the talk this morning, Freud has consciously that, but anti-socialist, anti-Marxist, but his theory of human nature, that we're all sort of got all these drives and things which we, you know, which we can't control, and therefore we need some sort of outside authority, a state or civilization to sort of to channel it. And this, I can't see how anybody who is a materialist and a socialist can accept anything from Freud. But there's a book, I mean, he's been exposed many times now, there's all his casework wasn't done properly and all this sort of thing. I mean, we shouldn't be basing our arguments on him at all.
Yes, it was the red rag, wasn't it, of saying Freud. Let's say that these are pure metaphors,
metaphors.
No, I never mentioned Reich. You mentioned Reich. It has nothing to do with the case, as far as I'm concerned. Now, the fact that he might have read Freud and believed a lot of what Freud said is neither here nor there. I find Freud metaphors useful. If you don't like the term energy, we could use the term appetites, which then is fair enough. However, what is undeniable is the drive, or whatever, again, is a metaphor. The urge, is that metaphorical? It is, actually, yes. We have no way of talking about it but metaphor. The fact that men think about sex, so they say, six times every 6 minutes, apparently is an observed fact. The fact that if you go out on a warm summer's evening in a congenial, say, seaside place, you see young men and women walking up and down, eyeing one another, is a fact. The fact that one of the most pleasurable things in life is sexual intercourse is a fact. Now, all of these are true. They have nothing to do with theories, and they have nothing to do with metaphors. So I can avoid them if necessary. But it does require a great deal of itemization of things like that to circumvent a metaphor. That is my problem. So I say I'm using Freudian metaphors rather than talking about the spirituality that Jung used, rather than trying to use behaviorism, which doesn't explain it at all. Now, I'm stuck. We want to talk about something which is deeply psychological and also deeply physical. How do we do it? I mean, some people do it with poetry.
I don't deny that sex exists, but the argument that you were using was that there's more than that, but there's some sex drive, sex urge, which can be diverted or repressed or something like that. I mean, I don't accept that. I mean, I don't see the evidence for it.
Yes, I'm not sure what there's an urge to do something that you can't do.
Hey, but why? Well, it could be the urge for something else. I mean, can these things? I mean.
Have you any theory at all as to why the Catholic Church imposed celibacy on its clergy? Any theory at all? Yes, go on. Because other people have thought before you over the centuries, and they've said so that all of this goes into religion.
Oh no! In the Middle Ages, some livings were becoming hereditary.
That's all right.
People wanted to put the damper on that. They didn't want. Because I think some marriage was allowed at that time, and they didn't want all parish priests to be able to pass on their livings to their sons and grandsons and so on. And that was why that was introduced.
Depends on the law of the particular land they're in, doesn't it? What the laws of inheritance are, but you may well be right. But I mean, right, well, I certainly use this sort of theory about what was instrumental in Morrison. It's up to you to provide another thing.
Well,
I think it's a Victorian repression had a considerable effect on the way people thought. Certainly about the way they thought about each other. If you keep couples apart in celibacy with long 15-year courtships and so on, they weren't uncommon at all. It began to have an impact. If you're thinking about it or something like it every few minutes of the day, what influence does it have? Does gratification have on the one hand, does consummation have? And on the other hand, what does repression have? Surely there are a different imitative situation. I'm trying to be as scientific as I can.
can be satisfied or not satisfied. The basis of Freud's theory that it's something that can be channeled somewhere else or something like
that. You're talking different terminology. That's what I'm offering you a chance to do.
Surely, Victorian society, these people, admit it as a sexuality. There was a prostitute every second on the door. Every second in the West End, the London these guys probably had more sex than the most wonderful society that's ever been dreamed up in the swinging 60s. I mean, if you read people a lot earlier than that, like that, Boswell, he seems well paid, don't he? He was a good prostitute. A very religious man. You know, he was deeply contrite and he shot his throat.
We're not talking about Boswell, we're talking about Morris. I mean, it's more entertaining to talk about Boswell, apparently.
Morris or anybody else in Victorian age, including Marx and Engels and all the rest of them, could it, I mean, this idea, by the way, the minute I hear Freud up to about the Goebbels, could he have a culture? I reach actually for the doorway.
Forget Freud. Talk in terms which have nothing to do with Freud. Talk about William Morris, which is what I was trying to do. Now, William Morris did believe in chastity before marriage for men as for women. He did not use prostitutes, as far as we know, nor did some of his friends. They all believed that men should have the same high standards, as they called them, as women were expected to have. Obviously, as I started out by saying, the basic reason for this was the monetary reason, wealth. But it became an ideal, as so many of the impositions of the ruling class do.
To me, this is the trouble on human beings. You know, a painter is a great painter. That's because he wasn't getting his end away. That's why Van Gogh was a great painter. Or Rembrandt, that's because he was getting on his way.
Well, you can advance that theory if you like. I'm not doing it.
But this is one of the things about sublimation. People who are sexually unfulfilled, and the analyst viewpoint, unfulfilled. A lot of people never have sex in their life, and have not got a great sex life. The thing about it is, why should men take a writer or a poet or anybody who produces something that can then look back and evaluate historically and say, there must have been a deep psychological sexual reason.
No, don't do that.
The man may just have been bloody brilliant at what he'd done.
All right.
That's how I prefer to look at it.
Right, now you really need to go back over what I said, haven't you? I explained the development of climate of thought in early Victorian England. A climate of thought which was based upon the material wealth of the rising capitalist class. Climate of thought which insisted upon chastity for women and couldn't just insist upon it because it was about material wealth, but had to erect it into a moral code, had to erect it into an ideal, so that you've got a body of thought about it. You've also got, this is where I said the energy came from, the revolution, not from the Romanticism, which was repression. What I did say about the Romanticism is this abstention, this putting off, became a habit of character with these people, with some of these people. That's to say, they were able to sacrifice themselves or their energies or whatever for some future goal, which immediate sexual gratification ignores. Immediate sexual gratification leads to contentment.
How does that impinge on the creation of wealth?
They wanted hereditary wealth to be well established. They wanted to be able to hand it on to offspring whose origins they could be sure of. They therefore, as most societies with any wealth have done, corralled their women in the best way they knew how. Stopped them having any freedom in the matter. Yes.
The problem is here that it's the male sex that is in charge. But if the woman sex can be a problem because you can only serve who the mother of the child is, but you can't only serve those fathers.
Right. Yeah.
And then, of course, from capitalism arises these notions of sexuality that are incorrect. If a woman was monogamous by nature, you can only be chastened for the first place. it's when you start to investigate the facts, you can see that it's capitalism brings about these ideas.
I totally agree with you. Incidentally, I have read that chastity belts have been a myth, an invention of later ages, and in fact they weren't used in medieval times, as is claimed, but I don't know. Oh, well, that's just, you're moving across into African cultures, aren't you? And,
practices that are not like
women. Oh, of course it is. Yes, I totally agree.
That's what you've got to do with property.
Well, we are going to recommend that certain businesses go out. So women buy up by another way.
And why would women do
it? That's women absorb male goats.
Part of that, yes. I think it's part of a ritual.
I can remember.
I think this is probably going on to...
It's interesting how many misconceptions there are.
I
just want to see a cup of tea and give you a certain authority.
Does anybody else want to come in that hasn't spoken yet?
You know, when you were talking about Norris's life, you mentioned the Bulgarian atrocity. It's just an anecdote, I suppose. Norris was on the side of the
liberals,
Russian, but Marx took the opposite view, you know, because he thought that, you know, the Tsarist Russia was a threat to the whole world, and you know, shouldn't undermine Turkey because it was a barrier against expansion. When he was writing articles under pseudonym in the Daily Telegraph, saying, you know, he was actually glad to give a loan to the Russians and so on, which, I mean, I suppose the purpose of this anecdote is that we're not committed to what, you know, people who were socialists happened to have done, and they were socialists, they contributed some of the socialists, but we don't have to slavishly defend everything they do, you know. In this particular case, we'd have to choose between Marx and Marx. I mean, I've always said that, you know, Karl Marx would never have been admitted to the party, but Marx would have been admitted and then expelled. It's higher up the hierarchy.
Yes, it's a... I take it Marx had got to the point where he could be dispassionate about it, which is a pity, really, because the Balkans were suffering in much the same way then as they are now, except it's a different lot. People ask very often, what's the socialist position on this? And which side would you take? Neither side. It's something that capitalism has produced, not us.
Anybody else? Any more points, comments? Okay, thank you very much.
See, won't be ready for a bit.